All right, thanks, everybody. You can have a seat. The first case that we have today is Colorado West Insurance Services versus Mulaga and others. May I have the entry of appearances, please, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, Damian Arroyo, registration 35719 for Colorado West.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Bradley Levine, registration 13095 on behalf of Mulaga.
And I gather that since none of you introduced your co-counsels, those folks are not going to be speaking, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and introduce them?
Yes, Your Honor, this is Dan Spivey, my associate.
And would you know some of them?
Yes, Your Honor, this is Terry Tencio.
Okay, very good. Gentlemen, this is our case. A 1 hour case. That means each side has 30 minutes aside. And that means you, Mr. Arroyo, will need to keep track of your own time, which you can do so very easily from the podium. And if you wish to reserve any of that time, just go ahead and stop and then you reserve it. Okay. So whenever you're ready, sir, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The interrelated petitions before you can be resolved on a simple and concise principle that this court laid down almost a century ago, which is that in the case of an alleged negligence by an insurance agent, no coverage equals no damages. 95 years ago, this court laid down that principle in the Mayhew case, and the Court of Appeals followed it in Pete Satire, which this court affirmed in the Bailey case. It's simple. The recoverable damages caused by an insurance agent's negligence are limited to the coverage available under the applicable policies. This rule is consistent with the principle in the Court of Appeals case in Manor Insurance, in which it held that from a policyholder standpoint, the insurance agent and the insurance company are indistinguishable. This rule is also consistent with the General Assembly's change to the Insurance Code in 1993, where it abandoned the traditional agent-broker distinction in favor of a generic insurance producer who is deemed to be the agent of the insurance company in any coverage dispute. Thus, this court need not even reach the question of due process or the question of whether there was a waiver of privilege, because if the relief that Mulaga is seeking is not legally valid to begin with, due process becomes moot, as does the waiver. Now, in the Court of Appeals, neither Mulaga nor the Court of Appeals cited any authority for the principle that an insurance agent's liability extends beyond the policy limits. So there's no justification, either in terms of case law or rationale in the Court of Appeals' opinion, justifying a departure from this court's basic principle. Now, the trial court granted summary judgment to Colorado West based on this principle because it effectively found that the policy language, all four of the policies in this case, the language was substantially identical, and it all excluded any duty to defend or indemnify Mulaga against the old bond lawsuit. Now, briefing to this court, Mulaga all but concedes that concept because they say that its claim doesn't rise and fall on the coverage determination because Mountain States defended Mulaga under a full and complete reservation of rights and contributed money to the old line settlement. And what they say is that had Mountain States received notice earlier, Mountain States would have defended earlier and contributed more money to the old line settlement. But by definition, Mountain States' defense under a full and complete reservation of rights included the right to reclaim those payments should it be determined that there was no coverage, which effectively that is what happened at the trial court and at the Court of Appeals. So those payments were ex gratia and fully retractable. So Mulaga has no right to those payments. Nor is there any support in the record for the idea that Mound States would have contributed more to the old wine settlement, because we have an affidavit in the record from Mound States General Counsel saying that their payment was not driven by any prejudice caused by late notice. In other words, late notice wasn't factored in what they decided to pay. So again, Malaga's claim is essentially that Colorado West deprived Malaga of a benefit or payments to which Malaga was not entitled. So it's really simple. Either coverage is owed, and a negligent insurance agent would owe payments that it caused the insured to be deprived of, or those payments are gratuitous and retractable, and therefore the agent is not liable for them because the policyholder is not entitled to them. Now, in this case, Mountain States does not appear to be inclined to claw back the payments it already made, even though it could have a right to, which basically makes for a nice windfall for Malaga. But that doesn't mean that they have the right to seek another windfall from Colorado West. Now, in case the court is concerned about the equities of letting an agent who is negligent off the hook, and by the way, there's been no determination that Colorado West had or breached a duty to Malaga to give notice in this case. But if the court is concerned about those equities and that a negligent agent should get off the hook, recall that the reason that there's no coverage, one of the primary reasons there's no coverage in this case, is because the old Vine lawsuit alleged that Malaga engaged in a fraudulent scheme to defraud old Vine of its property. I said these issues are interrelated because what matters here is the relationship between Colorado West and its insurer principal. There's no dispute that Colorado West is both statutorily and contractually the agent of Mountain States. Now, in the Manor Insurance case, the Court of Appeals held that the agent and the insurance company were indistinguishable from the policyholder standpoint, and that's why the agent was bound by the underlying settlement in that case. So it can't be both ways. Either Colorado West and Mountain States and the other insurers are one and the same from the policyholder standpoint and liable to the same extent, or Colorado West is distinct from the insurance companies and has a right to challenge the reasonableness of the old wine settlement and leave the burden of proving that reasonableness with Malaga. And that includes the right to obtain otherwise privileged information about the reasonableness of that settlement that Malaga could have issued by bringing this case to the end. So taking a step back from a high level, all this court needs to do is uphold its longstanding precedent that an agent is only liable for the benefits provided by the policy. Doesn't need to get to the due process argument at all, doesn't need to get to the privilege waiver issue. Turning to Malaga's due process claim, as a preliminary matter, there's a dispute about whether this was properly preserved and what the standard of review is. But getting to the essence of the due process claim, this entire appeal is about causation. In its complaint, Malaga said that Colorado West caused Malaga to lose insurance benefits that Mountain States and the other insurers would have otherwise provided had they received timely notice. The trial court granted summary judgment on the basis of lack of causation, saying that there was no coverage and therefore there was no causation of damage. And the Court of Appeals largely affirmed that summary judgment as to the other two insurers, Charter Oak and American Guarantee, on the basis of causation because of no coverage. And with respect to the old Vine settlement, the Court of Appeals said, well, causation was cut off as to that aspect of Malaga's claim because Malaga settled in the United States. However, it reversed the trial court with respect to the defense benefits that Mountain States otherwise allegedly would have paid had it received time to notice, saying that there was a fact issue. Again, I think that's wrong, but in essence, the Court of Appeals was focused entirely on causation, which has been an issue for almost 5 years now. So it's a little hard for Malaga to say that it was surprised or didn't have adequate notice that causation was going to be discussed. The fact of the matter is that in its briefs, Malaga says the discovery is complete and has identified no additional discovery that it would need on this issue. And on that basis, when the record is essentially complete on an issue, this court has held that it and other appellate courts can address an issue sua sponte that appears in the record. Even though neither party raised it in briefing and the court and the trial court didn't address it. Now, with respect to the property interest that's actually at stake here, in its reply, Malaga says that the interest was it was the right to seek compensation for a category of damages caused by Colorado West conduct. That's what it says that the Court of Appeals deprived it of. Now, I'm not a due process expert, but that really sounds like a cause of action to me. And what's happened here is not that the Court of Appeals deprived Malaga of due process. They were in the midst of providing process. They were adjudicating that cause of action. It also sounds like what Malaga is seeking here is the right to a specific remedy, right, to argue a sub-issue before the Court of Appeals. And again, the case law is very clear that a party is not entitled to a specific remedy, whether that remedy is relief like damages or a specific process, because due process is flexible. It's whatever the court needs it to be in a particular situation. And the court has to balance its caseload and other priorities along with the party's right to due process. So under the case law and under this court's rules and its practices, it has the discretion to raise an issue sua sponte, as does the Court of Appeals. Furthermore, when an issue is one a matter of law, this court has held in the past that it can take that issue up, even though the parties didn't recognize it in the courts below. The courts below didn't address it, and that's in the Roberts versus American Family case. So again, with undisputed facts in place, all of this is a matter of law. And effectively, Malaga's position would limit this court and other appellate courts to questioning based on the specific arguments that are raised within the party's briefs. And I don't think this court is handcuffed in that manner. Now, certainly no one would have faulted the Court of Appeals had it decided to order supplemental briefing, but it wasn't required to. Due process didn't require it. Also interesting here is Malaga doesn't say what it would argue if it was given a chance. It can't argue that there's any support in the record for getting the old line settlement, again, because the record shows that Mountain States wouldn't have contributed anything more. So ultimately, all good things must have an end, even this action. I'd like to turn briefly to our argument that notice to Colorado West bound Mountain States. And again, this rests on the principle that an insurance company is indistinguishable from a sales force, from the agents that represent it. And this is a logical rule. We have to presume that the General Assembly intended to protect consumers here when it changed the rule. And that makes sense. It makes sense to bind an insurance company with the notice of its agents. That way, and the case law bears this out, if the Court of Appeals decisions where the Court of Appeals excuses a policyholder's failure to meet its good faith duty, or excuse me, its duty to give timely notice when an agent tells the policyholder not to for some reason. The Court of Appeals in those cases does not enunciate the principle underlying that. But what makes sense here is that the insurance company is bound by its agent's actions. And so if the insured is prevented from giving timely notice because of something an agent does, it makes sense to bind the insurance company with the knowledge that the insurance agent had about the specific claim. So in this case, there really was no notice. Mountain States really had no basis, if its policies provided coverage, to decline pretender defense costs. And that factors into the reasonableness of the settlement with Old Vine. If there was no basis for Mountain States to withhold payment, then why was it necessary to settle with Old Vine to begin with? was the amount that was sought and recovered from Mountain States accepted because of late notice issues, as Malaga claims, or was it really because there was a coverage issue to begin with? There was a likelihood that the policies were not going to provide coverage. We don't know that. The only person who really knows the motivations that Malaga had for settling is Mr. Levine, Malaga's counsel who negotiated the none agreement in this case. Now, the lower courts held that it was Colorado West that put that privileged information at issue, and not Malaga. But I think that's a misreading of this court's holding. This court adopted in the defeat case the principle in Hearn versus Gray that basically it's claims or defenses that are at issue. So it's incumbent upon an attorney in evaluating a case and determining that they're going to bring it to think through what's going to be at issue. And if it's going to put privileged information at issue, then that's a factor that the attorney needs to consider. Again, the information that is being sought is not available from anyone else. It's not available from Mr. Hutchinson, who during his deposition, to the extent he was allowed to answer questions concerning his knowledge of these matters when there wasn't a privilege objection, said basically that he left all of the negotiation up to Mr. Levine. Mr. Dietrich couldn't answer it. He could answer specific questions about his defense of the underlying case, but he was not present in the room during the mediation and was not privy to the thought process behind the settlement. So ultimately, Malaga's claim is that it had no choice but to settle in this case because of Colorado West's alleged late notice here. But again, they were never entitled to the relief that they're seeking. Those payments the Mountain States made and possibly would have made were not owed under the policy. They were fully retractable. Mountain States could have pulled those back at any time, and maybe even still could. So in short, this case really boils down to that simple principle. No coverage means there's no damages. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Levine?
Good morning, may it please the court. This case involves a number of different kinds of procedural quandaries, I think. And the first one is that counsel, as part of his presentation, as in his briefing, talks a lot about the question of whether or not there's any liability in the first place, as far as his client goes, and has talked about the question of whether or not notice to the broker constituting notice to the insurance company, those kinds of issues, which gets to the question, what he has asked this court to do is to reach out and grant summary judgment, say that the trial court was right and that you should grant summary judgment. I mean, that's what he's asking this court to do. Now, from our perspective, he asked, when I say he, the Colorado West submitted a petition for writ of certiorari to this court. They asked for three issues to be certified. Two of them are issues which Mr. Arguello talked about now and also included in the briefing. The problem is that this court declined cert as to those issues. This court granted certiorari as to two very confined issues. One having to do with whether or not there was a due process violation by the Court of Appeals by its failure to have given us notice and opportunity to be heard with respect to this damages issue, and specifically with respect to the issue of whether or not we can get damages against Colorado West predicated on the underlying judgment. That's the first issue that this court took up, and the second issue had to do with the discovery question of whether or not because of the bringing of this lawsuit, the mere bringing of this lawsuit and the claims that are being made, that Colorado West is entitled to take my deposition as well as that of Ms. Intensia. Those were the only two cert issues that were granted by this court. This court's cert grant contemplated that there's going to be a remand, that there's going to be a trial. That's what the Court of Appeals said in its order. And what Colorado West has done under the notion that somehow the issues of whether or not you got a notice to the broker constitutes notice to the insurance company, or the issue of whether or not because of the fact that there was no coverage under the policy, which is what the trial court sort of innovated here, that because of that, that you don't even need to get to these other issues, you can just simply grant summary judgment and say that the trial court was wrong. But again, this is not an issue or issues which this court agreed to hear. And they are not intertwined issues. They are not issues that need to be decided in order for this court to reach the two issues that were taken up on cert, the due process issue and the privilege waiver issue.
I understand that argument. Let me ask you this, Mr. Levine. It seems to me like issue three, which is the privilege issue, probably needs to be decided. So what about issue one? Is it your position that you probably improvidently granted cert with respect to that one?
No,
Why don't you help me sort those out?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The question, first of all, in terms of whether the privilege issue needs to be decided, in actuality, I don't know. We've argued, I think, quite persuasively, but that question right now is a new question.
All right. Help me with that one first.
Absolutely. So what you have is that under the state of this case right now, we have an order from the Court of Appeals saying that we're going to remand this case for a determination, basically there's going to be a trial on the issue of the of whatever kinds of damages, whatever it is that we, Malaga, are entitled to, but it's going to be confined to the question of damages related to the defense costs. Okay, what they've said, what the Court of Appeals has said, you can ask for the defense costs, in other words, the cost that you were forced to expend between the time that notice was provided to Colorado West and failed to give that notice on to Mountain West, to Mountain States. That for that year and a half time frame, you can seek those damages, the dollars that relate to the defense costs, but not with respect to the amount of the judgment. The issue at this juncture, what Colorado West wants to do is to take my deposition as to the settlement, as to what the motivation was for the settlement, and so on. That's predicated on the notion that we're going to be seeking damages based upon that settlement, i.e., what was ultimately a $2.1 million judgment that was entered against Malaga. So at this juncture where things are sitting right now, the question of whether or not we can be deposed really is going to be impertinent under the state of things, unless if this court says that we can get those damages. In other words, if this court were to say we are entitled to, well, actually, we're not even asking this court to make that rule, okay? In other words, what we're asking this court to do is to give us a notice and opportunity to be heard, i.e., to return to the trial court to look at the question of whether or not we're entitled to receive damages predicated on the judgment. We're not asking for this court to make that determination. So until the trial court has ruled on that issue as to whether or not we are, in fact, able to seek those damages, then the question of whether or not I can be deposed, Ms. Tenso can be deposed, is not coachable. And if this court were to actually rule in against us and say that, well, okay, we were given appropriate opportunity to argue this issue, the Court of Appeals rightfully said we're not entitled to seek damages predicated on the judgment, then the whole reason for our being deposed is going to go away. So either way, at this juncture, at the state of the record right now, the question of whether or not we need to be deposed, in other words, whether or not we could issue this question, isn't right. It's not. It's mooted however you want to phrase it. The bottom line is it's not an issue this court needs to reach unless this court were to say, okay, this is something that's going to be repetitive, this is something of great public interest. Obviously, there are exceptions to moot this doctrine, but unless those exceptions apply here, it's not an issue that this court needs to reach at this juncture. Now, so that's the response. That as to the due process issue, that is certainly something that this court needs to look at. And I'm just going to quote this court in the Moody versus People case in 2007, wrote that appellate courts do not sit as self-directed boards of legal inquiry and research, but essentially as arbiters of legal questions presented and argued by the parties before them. Counsel just says, they wrote in briefs and said, well, listen, you know, causation is always an issue. Well, of course, you know, I mean, obviously, in order for us to prove up your claim, you know, there are three elements. You've got to establish duty, causation, damages. That's true any time you're going to prosecute this kind of case. So obviously, causation is always going to be an issue. But that doesn't mean that any party needs to anticipate that a court is going to decide a case or some portion of the case without that matter having been first presented. In other words, without party arguing, well, you are not entitled to receive this modicum of damages, and this is the reason why.
Counsel, can I just ask you, and I appreciate where you're going, but where does this lead? I mean, what remedy, if we were to find that you were not given an adequate opportunity, what remedy are you asking for?
Your Honor, I
you were going to get there.
No, I wasn't get there. I have to tell you, I've been giving some thought in terms of if you're going to say, you know, how are we supposed to resolve this? What are we supposed to tell the courts, okay, to do in these kinds of circumstances? I think that at the minimum, that what you need to do is to say, look, if a court sees that there's an issue, I mean, obviously the Court of Appeals panel perceived an issue that had never been raised, okay? And I think everybody has to concede that, because it's not something that was ever raised in the trial court, it was never raised in the Court of Appeals. And part of it is that, you know, where Colorado West ended up winning the whole thing, right? The entire claim got booted for what the Court of Appeals agreed was the wrong reason. There was no reason for them to argue this point, okay? And I get it. But the point is that when the court says, okay, you were wrong, all right, the trial court was wrong as to this issue and throwing out because you didn't perceive the theory that we were prosecuting our case under. But however, when we remanded, we're going to limit the damages, okay? But again, that question of limitation of damages was never, ever briefed by any parties. If you're going to do that, I think it's sort of it's similar in some senses. The Rules Committee for the Federal Courts adopted, I think a couple of years ago, Rule 56D. And what they said is that, yes, a trial court potentially in that context, in the context of summary judgment, can on its own grant summary judgment. But what the court said is that before you can do that, Rules Committee says, before you can do that, you need to tell the litigants, tell the parties that you're going to do it, what it is that you think is going to happen. You got to give them, I think it's 15 days, to respond in some way, shape, or form to it. So I don't think that asking that there be some other type of rule such as that, and obviously I'm not saying, you know, you got to rewrite, you know, the public rules of procedure, but there needs to be at least some direction to say, if you're going to grant summary judgment in whole or part if you're a trial court, you need to give the parties an opportunity to be able to respond on the basis that you have found. I don't think it's any different for the Court of Appeals, which is what the Court of Appeals did here, which is to say, listen, if you have a concern, I think that there are a couple of things that the court could do. One doesn't really get to, okay, what's the quote remedy per se? I mean, one of the things that the panel could have done is to say, look, we have concerns, okay, that we don't quite understand this. In fact, we brought it up during the closed oral argument, and we're not really satisfied with the response we were getting from Logan's counsel. So, you know, we have a concern that you as the trial court on remand need to take a close look at. I mean, this is something that that we have, you know, you observe that this is a problem, but you don't say you can't get it, you can't get these damages. It should be something the trial court is going to do.
Well, counsel, can I? So you're focusing on what the Court of Appeals should have said in its opinion.
Well, yes, but then the other point is that before you can do it, we threw this out, and I know because the courts of appeal have done this on, you know, I think a more frequent basis in the last few years, is to at the very least allow for supplemental briefing. In other words, to say, and that's one of the things that we asked for in our petition for rehearing, is we said at the very least, please give us an opportunity to argue this point and to have fulsome argument, not just in the context of petition for rehearing, because obviously that's just, you know, one-sided, hey, you know, there was some kind of error that you made here. But in the context of a briefing in the court, I don't know, the court appeals has said, allow for 5-page briefs or something. But all we're saying is it's got some mechanism for the parties to be able to present argument with respect to this before you say, you can't get these damages. We never had that opportunity to be a party in the court.
Did the petition for rehearing include any of those arguments?
Your Honor, what our petition for rehearing, what we did is we made mention, in other words, we gave sort of an idea, if you will, as to what the argument would be. But, certainly a petition for rehearing is not the vehicle for fleshing out and saying, look, this is an argument that we never had an opportunity to fully brief, to talk about, to explain to the court, and we should have that opportunity to do it. What we did do, if the court looks at the petition for hearing, you will see that we did allude to what the argument was going to look like. But on the other hand, again, that's not the purpose of the petition for hearing, is to get into some kind of an argument with the court. It's the purpose of the petition for hearing is to say, look, if you have made some kind of grievous error of law and so on in what it is that you have. On the other hand, what we didn't have an opportunity to do, and quite frankly, it would be also Colorado West should have an opportunity to respond to that particular issue. And that's, again, not the purpose of the petition for a hearing.
That's back to me if you don't mind.
Sure.
So how to what extent was this a problem anticipated during oral argument?
It was, and if the court goes back and listens to the recording of the oral argument itself, it came up during the rebuttal, and I'd say probably the last minute or minute and a half of the rebuttal, maybe 2 minutes, and it was questioning by the court of Ms. Atencio on that issue. And it's actually, and her response is alluded to in the Court of Appeals opinion,
right,
because what she made mention of was the DC-10 case, and the court distinguished that and so on. But again, this is not anything that we ever, Ms. Tenso or anybody else, certainly from the law, had ever anticipated was going to come up in the course of the oral argument.
Before you get too far away from it, can I bring you back? I wasn't sure about you finished your response to Justice Ide's question. So what would you like us to do? Rule in your favor, remand to the Court of Appeals, and order them to give you a chance to brief this issue?
No, I think really what we need to do is, I really think it belongs is in the trial court. But I think ultimately it's a matter that belongs in front of the trial court, because I think that's what the Court of Appeals should have done. In other words, the Court of Appeals needs to say that this case is going back to the trial court on remand. There's, obviously there have been some real concerns about our ability to be able to recover damages based upon the judgment amount, and have that be an issue potentially that the trial court would decide.
Is that a somewhat different issue from your due process question that you weren't given a chance to respond?
Yeah.
So in effect now, are you saying this is a matter that requires factual determination, which is beyond the Court of Appeals' capability?
No, it's not a question of factual determination.
And so why can't the Court of Appeals deal with it?
Because we didn't get an opportunity to address the legal issue. In other words, to explain to the court.
In our rules, you talked about the rules. Do you think it pretty clearly says appellate courts can raise issues on their own, can deal with issues that they see that have been created by the record?
Yes, Your Honor, as long as they're in our record. But what I'm talking about is bases for a legal determination as to the entitlement to, or the ability to be able to pursue certain claims, to be able to pursue certain types of damages. In other words, all we're talking about is, yes, the court can obviously, under Rule 1D, obviously under the case law that's been established in the state, the court has an ability, the reviewing court does have an ability to look at the record and be able to make certain kinds of determinations based upon that. The point here, though, is that this is a legal argument. In other words, the question of causation as to our ability to be able to obtain it. Ultimately, we believe that it's a factual matter that should be decided by a juror, okay? But, obviously, it rises to the level of a legal determination. Essentially, it's a summary judgment, a partial summary judgment, as to a linkage, the causation issue between the conduct of Colorado West and the damages that we are seeking in the case. So ultimately, what the Court of Appeals has done is granted sua sponte a summary judgment in favor of Colorado West as to this monitoring of damages and saying because you can't establish the causal link. And the trial and the Supreme Court appeals says why. He said that there was, you know, the causation was superseded by the agreement we reached and so on. The problem is that what the Court of Appeals, the determination the Court of Appeals reached was one which we never had an opportunity to deal with other than in that one and a half minutes or 2 minutes.
And can I rephrase that? And can I rephrase that?
Sure.
Just in terms of how I would understand that. And so when you say it's ineffective granting a matter for summary judgment, I take it then you are saying this is a matter of disputed fact and it could only be resolved one way or the other if the standards for summary judgment were met. Under the trial court.
Let me just make it clear. We think at the end of the day that we have a good, palpable basis for going to a jury and asking a jury to decide whether or not because of Colorado West conduct that we're entitled to not only the amount of the defense costs that they incurred during that, you know, 18 plus month time frame, but they're also entitled to receive the judgment that was entered pursuant to the terms of the Nunn Agreement. We think that that's something ultimately that there's a jury question to decide. So ultimately that's the jury's decide. It is the question of, you know, obviously causation. I mean, that's typically, it's part of jury instructions, is the jury's decide causation and damages. We think it's ultimately a jury question. But at the very least, that if this is a matter that a court is going to say that it's a matter of law, you aren't entitled to that because of the superseding cause or whatever it is. And trial courts do that and hold that as a matter of law. But if the court's going to do that, we need to be able to argue points why the court's wrong.
I'm sorry, Justice Gutsman,
please. If we're going to do the latter, why does it make more sense to send it to the Court of Appeals first to resolve that legal issue before it decides whether it's necessary to send it back?
And Your Honor, that may be the other path to go. In other words, what we're saying is that the Court of Appeals deprived us of an opportunity that we should have had, then it makes sense to have the Court of Appeals in the first instance give us that opportunity through whatever kind of the supplemental briefing, which, as we said in our briefs, is something that at the very least we should have afforded that opportunity through that briefing to be able to argue this point to the Court of Appeals. So, you know, that is, you know, a potential remedy as well. But all we're saying is that we need that opportunity to argue this point without the court having said, no, you're not entitled to seek these damages.
And they say we don't really understand what the point is yet because they haven't tipped their hand on that. Works to that effect in their opening argument. So, in a nutshell, if you can,
sure.
What argument would you advance?
Well, again, I'd like the opportunity to fully flesh it out.
Sure,
in front of the court, but essentially what it is this, is that you had the, because of Colorado West's failure to give notice to Mountain States, and after the Mountain States got notice, the base step and said, okay, fine, we're going to provide you with defense on a going forward base and under these kinds of parameters. But, you know, at the point at which they decided that, they were within a month before trial. And they were saying one of those parameters is that because we were so close to trial, we're not going to pay for Mr. Dietrich's case. We've got another lawyer, we're going to have that lawyer step in and trial. The problem is that lawyer in a very complicated case wasn't going to be up to the task to be able to do it. So long story short is that Milagro was facing having to continue to pay their counsel, Mr. Dietrich, to get ready for trial and to try the case. And so you're talking about all those legal expenses that they were going to have to incur that they otherwise would not have had the votes been given a year and a half prior to. So they were going to have to expend those expenses. Plus, they faced the prospect of a potentially large verdict. And so the causation piece here is that facing all of these financial liabilities, that they made a providential decision that they entered into these negotiations and made the providential decision to go ahead and settle on the terms that they did. In other words, to take this money that was being offered by the insurance company, along with monies that Milagro had to pay out, to settle the claims with Old Line, and to enter into the Nunn Agreement. It was because of bottom line, because of ongoing financial issues, the cost that they had on a going forward basis, that they made the decision that they were going to go ahead and enter into this agreement. So that is the relationship, the cause and effect between the conduct by Colorado West and the determination that they were going to enter into this agreement, which resulted in this judgment, the $2.1 million judgment, which is part of the damages they're being claimed in this lawsuit by lawyer.
That does sound like a question of fact.
I think so, Your Honor. And so I
don't know how we... I mean, I'm interested now, having heard this sort of proffer, if you will.
Yes, sir. Yes,
that it could possibly go back to the Court of Appeals.
That's what I'm saying. I'm suggesting a couple of alternative avenues. It would strike me that going to the Court of Appeals is sort of, it's going to take more time, okay, in terms of...
Well, the Court of Appeals would have to say it's a question of fact and send it back.
That's exactly right.
And when the Court of Appeals said, no, it's not a question of fact, as a matter of law, there was no causation, whatever, as a matter of law.
Yeah, they didn't. I have to see if they used the term as a matter of law. But, the only way that the court said that it did was to say that it was a matter of law.
Sure, I was actually just looking for the language from the Court of Appeals opinion, and I can't find it, but
could I just jump in there? Because I was looking for it as well. I'm wondering if the part that you're concerned about is where the Court of Appeals says, however, although we agree that the negligence claim against Colorado West may proceed, we disagree with your contention that its damages against Colorado West could include the amounts awarded in arbitration.
Right.
And then it goes on to state your DC 10 case.
That's right.
And that's essentially, I'm just putting the pieces together here, that's essentially what you're saying, that was the only opportunity you had to cite this one case at the end of oral argument.
That's right.
To respond to the Court of Appeals.
That's exactly right, John.
Okay. Thank you.
That's it. And so, yes, you have to infer to the court if they're saying that, but that's as a matter of law. They have to be saying that. So those are concerns, and those are what we believe are the appropriate remedies. I want to then, get to this whole issue as far as the discovery and take our...
Can I stop you right there?
Sure.
Understand what you want to have happen. What is our holding?
Your holding is that one of two things. Either this court finds that what the Court of Appeals did is a violation of our due process rights by not giving us
that. I understand that's the result. But what do you want our ruling to be? Because we write a rule. So what is our holding? We therefore hold that.
What you hold is that if a court is going to grant or if the court is going to determine as a matter of law that a party is not entitled to some form of relief, either in whole or in part, and is going to do it on a basis other than what the parties have argued. And when I say other than, I'm still recognizing what Justice Coates was asking about, certain matters of record that can be recognized and so on. But if it's going to go into a territory as far as an argument that has not been raised either by the trial court or briefed in the Court of Appeals, that before a court's going to do that it needs to alert the parties, both parties, and give them the opportunity to be able to respond to it. And what that looks like, as I said, when the trial court, it's something, like I say, along with the rule of 56D is a good, at least, federal procedure, at least gives you a good template for what that looks like. We're talking about the Court of Appeals, either same thing, either remand to the trial court for initial determination, allow for supplemental briefing. There has to be some vehicle that the court's going to allow for parties to address that particular issue. It's something that the trial court or the Court of Appeals observes is they have concerns about whether or not that's a viable claim or not.
That's a long hold, but let me ask you this. How would we reconcile that with 1D, as Justice Coates kind of talked about? I mean, it's hard to find out what's not before the court.
Right. And the answer is that if we're talking about, a question of, certainly if it's something which is, so for example, we've got rules that say that if the court grants summary judgment on one basis, the court can, the reviewing court can do it on another basis that appears of record. Okay, we know that, and it again has to appear of record. In other words, that something which, because of all the facts that are in front of it, the documents that are in front of it, and so on, so when we think that some judgment is appropriate, but not for the reasons the trial court said. Okay, that's one thing. But on the other hand, what we're talking about here is a legal a legal theory. It's basically saying that we think that as a matter of law that you aren't entitled to pursue this particular claim. And again, it's a legal matter that you are restricted from doing it. And this is what the legal basis for it is. But that's not something that was ever brought out. In other words, no one ever argued that particular point. In other words, none of the parties ever argued that point.
And counsel, if I could just interrupt you, there is perhaps simpler simply to just say that the Court of Appeals erred by reaching an issue that was not presented to it.
Yes.
And simply vacate that aspect of the Court of Appeals decision.
And Your Honor, I was about to say, you know, in response to Justice Boatwright's question, which is that you either do it on the due process grounds, or that I think, and we presented, that there's just basically some very basic, you know, well-established law from this court on this issue. In other words, for the under the Malott Preston cases, for example, where you say, listen, we're not going to reach issues and decide things that were never presented either to the trial court or Court of Appeals. So that's another alternative, to say, listen, this is a violation of the law that we've already well established. And I would agree with that. You don't even need to be talking about due process.
And then should we repeal 1D then? Or is it, does that make no sense if we say we're not going to reach any issues that are not presented to us?
No, you can, but the point is that it's one thing, again, for you to say, listen, you know, based upon the record before us, there's an argument summary judgment that's been granted in your favor, and we agree that summary judgment should be granted, but it's on a different ground, okay? That's a different thing from saying, listen, we don't even have the issue in front of you, never ever dealt with the issue of whether or not you can recover this modicum of damages or not. No one has ever argued that point. And so, no, I think it's very consistent with 1D to say, if you're going to make that determination, if you're going to reach that issue, that you just need to get the briefing from the parties on the issue rather than having the court decide on its own. Because again, you're running afoul of what this court said in the Mooney case and what, you know, several...
But isn't that different from your answer to Justice Marcus, where I thought you said, yeah, you could just say the Court of Appeals erred by reaching an issue that was not presented to it?
You could.
But that's different from saying that they didn't give you a chance to brief it, isn't it? Or am I missing something in what you're arguing?
Well, the result's the same, Your Honor. Either way that you get there, you're vacating what the Court of Appeals did and saying, you know, because I've got to presume that given this guidance that, you know, that this is something that the broker, the Colorado West, is going to want to pursue. And they can pursue that issue in the trial court. They want to make that argument to the trial court in the first instance to say, listen, it's a matter of law, they can't recover these damages, and here's why. Fine, we'll argue that point out in the trial court, but it's no different. All we're asking, remember that we're asking for this to say, is to vacate that aspect of the Court of Appeals opinion and to allow the entire matter to remand to the trial court for determination, for further proceedings. And what those proceedings look like, I agree. I think that there are some questions of fact that will ultimately have to go to the jury. Maybe Colorado West is going to be able to convince the trial court, but as a matter of law, that they can prevail on this issue. But at the very least, in the first instance, it should go back to the trial court or potentially the Court of Appeals, but I think that the more direct path is through the trial court to make that decision. My time is up. Thank you very much. Again, we would ask that we be able to argue these matters in front of the trial court and that the issue as far as whether or not we're going to be deposed is something that we don't think the court really needs to reach a discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Mr. Arnold?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's incumbent to take a step back again and think about what the court's role is here. And one of the things the court needs to do is avoid propounding an error of law or a misjustice. And I've still not heard any legal basis for Malaga to collect from Colorado West payments to which it was not entitled and to which the insurance company could reclaim.
Mr. Aguayo, let me over here.
Yes, sir.
Let me redirect you slightly. What's your position on how this was brought up to the Court of Appeals? How was this in front of the Court of Appeals? Their argument is we were surprised by this. I understand you want to get to the merits, but how was this before the Court of Appeals?
The question of what the scope of Colorado West damages was?
Well, basically, what I hear Mr. Levine saying is they granted summary judgment, and that wasn't one of the issues that were appealed. How did you feel like the briefs and the issues that were appealed were before the Court of Appeals to make its determination?
Well, I feel like the issues were before the Court of Appeals in the form of a complete grant of summary judgment across the board to Colorado West on the basis of no coverage equals no causation, no damages. And so we consistently argued that the payments that Mountain States made and would have made had they given earlier notice, if they would have made those payments, were purely voluntary or gratuitous. So I think it was argued in the briefs before the Court of Appeals that was the issue.
Okay. All right. Can I ask you a little more formal question related to the way you've phrased this argument? As Mr. Levine points out, and do you disagree with this, you actually raised the issue you now want us to decide much more expressly in a question in the petition for cert, which we denied.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, obviously, it's kind of a broad standard about what kind of question would be fairly included in anything we granted on. But if the question you want to raise was actually expressly presented to us in a petition and we deny it, do you think we could say it's fairly included in a separate question that we granted?
Yes, Your Honor, I think you could, because on the question of due process, which you did grant, I think the due process argument hinges on the legitimacy of the remedy or the relief being sought. And if that's not a legitimate basis to get relief, then basically the due process claim is removed. And to the extent the court didn't grant cert on this issue, I can't speak to those reasons. But I would submit that perhaps I didn't explain it correctly in my petition and explained it better in the briefs.
And if I could only just phrase that slightly, since it was presented more expressly, it's not just that we didn't grant cert on it, we denied cert on it. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, Your Honor. But I do think it was fairly encompassed in the issues that are before the court, both okay. on the due process issue as well as on privilege waiver issue, because again, it goes to what Colorado West is entitled to discover if the settlement was not binding. So either Colorado West is linked to the insurers and only limited to, only owes what the insurers owes, or it's different and they get to challenge the settlement and they get to probe into the privilege issues if Malaga put them at issue.
Counsel, can I get you to address your opposing counsel's argument that essentially that at-issue argument is moot? Can I get you to directly address that? Do you agree with that?
Your Honor, what I heard him say anyway is that that the only way it's not moot is if this court grants some relief on their due process claim and that this has to go back to either the Court of Appeals or the trial court. If it goes back to the trial court, what we've got here in Colorado West is that the trial court and the Court of Appeals got it wrong on what constitutes an at waiver issue of privilege. And this court needs to provide some guidance as to what the correct rule is. So the court does need to address it. Providing guidance to the lower courts is one of those exceptions to mootness. So it's not completely moot. If this court agrees with Colorado West that the trial court summary judgment grant was proper and the rule that no coverage is no damages is the rule, or if the court agrees with the Court of Appeals that Malaga cannot collect the underlying settlement from Colorado West, then I would agree that then it's moot.
Thank you.
With respect to the question of whether the court can take up an issue that hasn't been briefed, it's kind of like a standing issue, and I think the precedents are pretty clear that the court can ask questions about issues that the parties didn't identify, and if the party misses the standing issue or some other fundamental issue, the court can still go there, it's incumbent upon the parties to recognize all the issues that could come up in their argument. Again, we're talking about causation, which has always been at issue.
Mr. Correa, how would you articulate your boundary then of when it would be impermissible? Right? When would there be unfair surprise that would implicate due process concerns, if ever? Well, I just heard the flip side.
Yes, Your Honor. I think if there was an issue that was completely not addressed, we're talking about proximate causation on undisputed facts, on a record that Malaga says is basically complete. I mean, I keep hearing talk about trial court deciding some issue of fact. The only issue of fact that I'm aware of that was raised is whether or not Mountain States would have defended. But if the Court of Appeals had brought up some case or issue that the parties hadn't discussed at all about maybe say did Colorado West have a duty of good faith and fair dealing in some way, or just completely unaddressed, then I think that's fair. That's not something the parties can really contemplate coming up in the course of an oral argument. If I answered the question,
the out of left field doctrine.
Exactly. I think the better rule in terms of the holding is that what is in place now is exactly correct, that the appellate court has discretion to raise matters that appear of record. To handcuff the court and say that they can't raise an issue just because the parties didn't address it or the court didn't rule on it, especially when it's intertwined with an issue that are before the court, it is really going to be limiting on the courts. And I would say if the parties have the ability to seek supplemental briefing and argue on every sub-issue that comes up that's part of what's before the court, then I think we're going to need to hire a few more clerks, because I think we'll see some more appeals. So ultimately, I think the court has the ability to address these issues that come up. But again, I don't think they need to go there. I think the rule that the court had for going back for 100 years is a good rule. It provides good notice to the insurance agents, to the insurance industry in general, that they are liable only for what their principals would have provided under the policies. If the court is going to depart from that rule in any form, in the opinion that it issues in this matter, I think it would be really helpful to the industry to understand why, especially when Malaga and the Court of Appeals didn't cite any authority for it. There's no legal principle justifying that departure. But if the court sees one, then it would be really helpful to the industry to hear what that is.
Counsel, can I just follow up on that? I mean, essentially what the Court of Appeals, it didn't agree or disagree with what you're saying. On that point, you just said the record was unclear on this point. Do you disagree with that?
I think, Your Honor, that's what they said, but I disagree to the standpoint, to the effect that, or from the standpoint that there was an underlying principle there that they didn't enunciate, which is basically, and the only one I can think of, Your Honor, and I hesitate to even say it, is that in some manner it's foreseeable that some insurance company somewhere is going to defend, notwithstanding that it has no legal obligation to do so. But to the extent that's what was in the Court of Appeals' mind, that this is a foreseeability issue, I think it still makes sense to take a step back and realize that those payments could be withdrawn. They're not something that a policyholder can count on keeping. And they shouldn't be entitled to get them from the agent when they're not entitled to keep them to begin with. Again, Mountain States could seek them back to get them back. Moreover, again, in this particular case, the conduct that was alleged by Malaga was that they were looking for something that they were entitled to. They were allegedly trying to defraud a neighboring property owner. And under those circumstances, they really shouldn't be able to keep the benefits that they got. As a practical matter, they probably will, but that doesn't mean they should get more benefits out of Colorado West. If there are no more questions, thank you.
All right, thanks very much.
Mr. Aguayo, is there? Thankful for your argument, as we are for you, Mr. Levine. Should we go ahead?